Richard Wrangham is a primatologist and the author of Demonic Males and the Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence. This is Richard Wrangham. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I am here with Richard Wrangham. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
So you have a book, your most recent book, The Goodness Paradox, and it's a fascinating book, and I highly recommend people read it. But just to sort of set the basis for what we're going to talk about here, the paradox mentioned in the title, correct me if I'm wrong, is basically that we're slow to aggression in person, but we have the organizational capability to carry out large-scale violence. Is that kind of correct?
Yeah, that's kind of a sort of delicate way to put it, I suppose. What I think of as a paradox is the fact that on the one hand, we are one of the most peaceful of animals. If you just measure it in terms of the frequency of dyadic aggression, of personal aggression, whereas people just move about their daily lives, we are remarkable for the low frequency of aggression compared to the majority of animals. And yet at the same time, we are capable of appalling violence, which puts us right at the far end of what animals do in terms of killing each other. So the paradox is that we are on the one hand very unaggressive, and on the other hand, we're highly aggressive. And what does that mean?
Right. And so what is, in your book, you talk about, and again, I'm going to pose this statement, and correct me if I'm wrong, elaborate on it. Basically, there used to be alpha males that would monopolize all the women resources, and they were highly aggressive in person. And this became a problem. So I guess the more organized, less aggressive so-called beta males were able to team up together to overthrow these alphas and install a gentler society. But that process for organizing amongst themselves also enabled people to be more violent on a large scale. Is that correct?
Well, it has all sorts of elements of correctness, and I'm not sure I exactly agree with you that.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
So the way you put it was that the capacity for violence is a consequence of the dynamic of the beta males forming coalitions to be able to suppress the alpha male. I'm sure it helped, but at the same time, I think that the capacity for organized violence was there beforehand. And the reason I say that is that we see it in chimpanzees that go out and kill members of neighboring groups without having gone through this process of selecting for reduced reactive aggression. So that probably was true in humans as well. But the essential claim is right, that obviously we don't have direct evidence that humans once had alpha males in which the most dominant male in a social group achieved his position through physical violence and used it to claim resources, including mating rights to many or all of the females.
Sorry to interrupt. You said we don't have evidence for that?
We don't have direct evidence.
Okay.
We don't have a movie that takes us back half a million years. But what we do have is very clear evidence from the primate world and from animals in general that you have alpha males that achieve their position by dominating. And at some point, it sure seems as though in our ancestors, we would have had that same system. And in many ways, the question in my book, or a question in the book, is when was that true? Was it true with some species of Homo? Was it true with Australopithecines? Was it true only earlier? And I conclude that it was true up to about 300,000 years ago on the basis of the anatomical changes that we see in particularly the males.
So talk a little bit about those anatomical changes. What evidence does that give for there being a shift away from this alpha male society?
Well, the big story that is associated with Homo sapiens, that is not associated, so far as we know, with any other species of Homo, is craniofacial feminization. In other words, males getting faces that look more like females.
Mm.
So males getting narrower faces, faces that had reduced brow ridges, faces that were altogether bigger, altogether smaller. The remarkable thing about this is the trend for males to become less male-like and more female-like. And in animals, when we see that, it's associated with a reduction in male aggressiveness. And so it seems to me far and away the most reasonable thing to assume is that just as humans are now rather low in the scale of this day-to-day reactive aggression, then the time when they trend towards a reduction in that kind of aggressiveness happened was when we see the reduction in maleness in the heads and faces.
What's fascinating about what you're saying right now is that, you do go to some length to sort of inoculate these claims from any like political connotations, but there are a lot of people who are super right wing who would look at that and be like, oh, well, you know, clearly nature is on the side of the alpha males, and our society has become more feminized and womanized. And is that a concern you ever had when you were writing this book? And does that at all, I don't want to say impact your research, but is that something that's on your mind when you're discovering these things?
Well, to write about the evolution of aggression is something that is constantly nerve-wracking, in the sense that we know that people will use whatever means they can to support a particular viewpoint. And aggressiveness, of course, is something that is politically and emotionally very salient. So I'm always careful about it. And my aim is, as you hinted, to try and be as objective as possible about the information and not to use it for straight political ends. You said, was I worried that people on the right wing would use the notion of a reduction in aggressiveness and a feminization of males to their advantage? I'm sure they would, but so would people on the left wing.
Right.
In my mind, it's not really suitable for the political discussion either way. You know, it doesn't particularly matter what happened 300,000 years ago. what matters is what happens nowadays. But at any rate, the big point I would want to make, and I've always advocated for my co-workers and students and so on, is that we take extra care to avoid expressing the results of this sort of analysis in ways that could be misinterpreted.
Definitely. When you say the feminization, and also there's kind of a correlation there with maleness and violence. Why are men in particular so much more violent?
Well, as in the majority of species of mammals, at least, males have been selected to be good fighters, because the best fighters are the ones that end up having the priority of access to females for mating. You know, it's very crude, and we don't like to think about it that way. nowadays, quite rightly. But it's clear that the fundamental dynamic is goes back to sexual selection theory, which says that the selective advantage, the evolutionary advantage, goes to the males who are able to impregnate, who are able to achieve higher fitness for having more babies. And almost always this means, until society intervenes, that a male does better by fighting other males in order to get access to many females. So there's been selective advantage in terms of males being good fighters in terms of their muscles and in terms of their minds, in terms of their skills.
Okay, that makes sense. I suppose the converse of that would be, okay, well, for females, is the reason then that those like aggressiveness and violence is not as valued in terms of getting a mate, to put it in these biological or primitive ways, is the reason that's not valued for females because they have to carry a baby for 9 months in the case of humans? And why is that? You see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there would be some advantage to females in being able to be good fighters, but the advantage is not very much. And there's going to be a trade-off between your ability to fight and your ability to escape fights and therefore survive better by not having to get involved at all and not having a body that is adapted to the stresses of fighting, be they for preparation or repair. So just as in males, the advantages of fighting are sufficient that it is worth sacrificing some of your ability to survive. So in females, the advantages to fighting are not sufficient, and therefore it's better to put effort, as it were, into long-term survival. So in every human society, males tend to die younger than females. And that's because males have been adapted to being able to fight each other.
Speaking of sufficient, I wanted to talk about this goodness paradox, where this ability to not lash out with the sort of reactive aggression seems like it'd be necessary in order to be able to carry out large-scale organized forms of violence, like, you know, genocides or war, but that it's not necessarily sufficient. In other words, the ability not to fight each other in person all the time, you have to have that to form a team, but that doesn't seem like it's enough to have that sort of mass scale violence. And also the mass scale violence of a Holocaust or something like that seems much more remote for a lot of people and doesn't seem to tap into the sort of primal urges that hitting someone in the head with a rock does. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yes. No, that's very true. And I make a big point in this book of distinguishing between two types of aggression: reactive aggression and proactive aggression. And you've mentioned those, hinted at them. And I think it's kind of fascinating that although proactive aggression is in many ways far more impactful in human society, it gets much less attention. So if you look up in textbooks of human psychology or animal behavior, you will see a lot of attention paid to reactive aggression, which is the aggression that happens when two individuals meet, and in the case of animals, males fight over a female. In the case of humans, it might be men fighting over an insult at a bar. It might be losing their temper on the football field. But it's not what happens in war. In war, the aggression is almost entirely planned. And that planned aggression is proactive. And let me take this opportunity to mention that the solution, as I see it, to the goodness paradox is that we tend to think that aggression is one thing, but actually it is two things. So the goodness paradox says, how come we are so nice in some ways, which is we are very low in reactive aggression, our tendency for reactive aggression, but we're very nasty in other ways. And what that means is we're very high on the scale of proactive aggression. So the paradox is resolved by saying, well, it's not a paradox because we've got two different things going on. One is reactive and one is proactive aggression. One we're very low on the scale, the other's very high on the scale. Well, you know, once you appreciate that, then you think about the importance to our species of these two different qualities. And as I say, the textbooks and all sorts of discussion is dominated by our concerns about an interest in reactive aggression, the type that is associated with passionate feelings, with impulsive behavior that is quite difficult to control when you get into the fight. But the type that is totally predominant in war, which is such a defining feature of our species, is proactive aggression. Because proactive aggression is planned, and war consists very largely of a series of exchanges that are planned. And very often they are asymmetric, in which a group from one side makes a deliberate effort to attack some unsuspecting people on the other side and kill them. Now, so this is this sort of odd contradiction, if you like, in humans, that we focus on reactive aggression as the biological part, which is what you were saying, and we tend not to think that the proactive aggression is part of our biology. And it was when, in the 1970s, the discovery of proactive aggression happened in chimpanzees in the wild, and then subsequently many forms of proactive aggression were found in different species, that we could start realizing that proactive aggression in humans fits into a pattern that we see quite broadly in animals in many different contexts. And therefore, from a biological perspective, our proactive aggression is simply an exaggeration of tendencies that are seen in other species. But because it's planned, because it's not associated with immediate, impulsive, emotional arousal, you're right. A lot of people find it difficult to imagine as being part of our biology.
What does that look like in the brain, this form of proactive aggression? Because I can picture, you know, adrenaline and fear centers lighting up when you're getting into a street fight. But if you're sitting in an air-conditioned building and piloting a drone that's 10,000 miles away and pressing a button that blows somebody up, if you read some of the transcripts, those people where they're talking, they're very calm and collected, as you would expect, I suppose, in this form of proactive aggression. But what are the biological mechanisms then that are taking place?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to get at in humans. Because what you want to do from a scientific perspective is experiments where you can put receiving devices, recording devices on particular neurons or nerve groups and figure out what's going on when people are being proactively aggressive. You can't do that. Maybe one day the ability to record inside the brain will improve. What you can do, I think is some very significant work has been done in rodents that shows that the neural tracts that are activated when a rat or a mouse is engaged in proactive aggression are very close to, but are distinct from, those that are involved in reactive aggression. So literally, you can take three sort of core units in the brain that are associated with aggressive behavior, the periaqueductal gray, the amygdala, and the hypothalamus. And there are neural tracts that run between these. And if you like, the different wires that are stimulated when reactive or proactive aggression occur are just adjacent to each other. And they're running between the same units, between the hypothalamus and the amygdala and the periaqueductal gray, but they're just different tracts. So it's very likely that that's what's happening partly in humans, because from what we know about the way in which aggression is controlled in humans, it's very similar to what it is in other mammals. So for instance, if you get a tumor that affects a relevant part of the reactive aggression system in humans, to judge from the rats, then it turns out that suddenly we got an excessively aggressive human. But relatively little is known about the proactive aggression, because we've only just recently got models of proactive aggression from the point of view of studying the neural mechanisms in rodents. So I'm expecting that more will be discovered. People have got some ways of getting at different parts of the forebrain by having these transcranial stimulation methods that can kind of turn off parts of the brain at some time, and you can manipulate the degree to which people are liable to proactive aggression doing that. But we're still at a very early stage.
Are we becoming less violent as a society?
Well, I mean, that's a question for Steve Pinker, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I'm totally with Steve Pinker in his analysis. You know, he reviewed elegantly a lot of material and showed very convincingly that at all sorts of timescales in the last few decades, few centuries, or even few millennia, you can talk about reductions in aggression in many different dimensions. So yes, you know, but I hasten to say that that's a Pinker question, because you know, I can't talk about that from an evolutionary perspective. In the evolutionary perspective, you've got to start thinking about tens of thousands of years.
Right.
And I'm sure that we are far less aggressive than we were a few tens of thousands of years ago, whenever you mention. I mean, we are definitely on a long-term trend of reduced aggression, to judge from the changes in our anatomy.
I get that you don't want to talk about it from, I mean, it's harder to talk about it from an evolutionary perspective. But my only thing with the Steven Pinker argument is the biggest eruption of violence in human history, which was World War II, occurred like less than a century ago. And we invented the weapons that could potentially wipe out human civilization. So I think, I mean, I don't know, this is my naive opinion, but it seems like we've definitely, along some metrics, like we're not as reactive in our aggression, but it seems like we still, I don't know. It feels like it depends a lot on what time scale you look at, right?
Well, the reason for saying that we are becoming less aggressive, even when you take account of the Second World War and other outbursts of violence in the 20th century, is that if you tot up the numbers, then you find that astonishingly, even when you think about the number of Russians who died in the Second World War and the large numbers in Germany and Europe generally, you still find that compared to the rates of death in small-scale war happening in small-scale societies, the actual rate of death is reduced. So, you know, you may have 20 million dead in the Second World War, but those 20 million come out of a population of whatever it is, you know, 200 million. So what Pinker did was to show very clearly what had actually already been demonstrated in a less public way by Lawrence Keeley, who assembled the data on small-scale societies and compared them to what you see in relatively contemporary societies. And You know, I always think about this in terms of a slide that I prepared on the basis of Keeley's work, which looks at the rates of death in some 30 small-scale societies and compares them with rates of death in Russia, Germany, Japan, France, and one other which I can't remember right now, during the 20th century, when you know, the latter European countries and Russia were involved in the First War and the Second World War. And astonishingly, you know, their bars are much lower than the ones in small-scale societies. Because it's a percentage. And the point is that in the small-scale societies, everybody was involved in war. Women were most often victims. Occasionally, they were involved actively. Men, all men got involved. And that's just not true in something like the Second World War, where you have a militarized group. You have the soldiers. And a lot of people stay home and hope to avoid the war and succeed in avoiding the war. So the mega death that we have become familiar with from history, a recent history, it's mega death because we got huge societies and huge armies and huge systems of killing, as in the concentration camps. But the actual rate, the actual probability of dying during the 20th century from violence was something like a tenth. I can't remember exactly, but I mean, you know, it's a big reduction compared to the chances of dying from violence in small-scale societies from the data we have.
Okay, that does make more sense. Do you think that there is any argument for the idea that maybe as reactive aggression goes down, this non-reactive or proactive aggression, I don't know, goes up, if only to sort of sublimate the these reactive urges that we're not acting on?
I don't see any relationship between them. I mean, I suppose it's conceivable, but the parallels between intergroup violence in chimpanzees and intergroup violence in small-scale human societies are pretty striking, in the sense that in both cases, the majority of interactions involve small groups of adult males deliberately attacking a lone male in the neighboring group and killing them and then running back to their own areas. It's not the only thing that happens in hunter-gatherer societies, but it is one that happens often. It's been described often and is very similar to what you see in chimpanzees. And I mention that because to the extent that that is something that is characteristic of humans, it is also characteristic of chimps, and yet chimps have not had any kind of reduction in reactive aggression. You know, they are highly reactively aggressive. They lose their tempers at a moment's notice. And so the fact that the chimps are very high on the reactive scale, whereas we're low, does not prevent them from being also high on the proactive scale. So I see these two things as largely independent.
Okay. Speaking of chimps, when you're studying chimps, do you ever get like chills or get worried about humanity? I mean, they are our closest relative, and they're pretty barbaric. I mean, there's a lot of murder and rape and all kinds of awful behavior. And when you see videos, at least videos I've seen of chimps, waging a battle or a raid, I guess you would call it, and killing a chimp from another tribe, and they seem like they're loving it. They seem like they're really having a good time and excited about what's going on. Does that give you any pause as a human being?
Yeah, no, that's right. Jane Goodall is very good on this sort of question, she was directing the field site in Gombe when people like myself were out there and making the observations of the chimps doing this stuff. Her response was that she had thought the chimps were just all, delightfully peaceful. And then when the discoveries mounted, showing that actually it was a systematic natural behavior of chimpanzees to go off and make these horrendous kills, then she recognized that in some ways it just made them all the more human. So at an emotional level, it drew her in some ways closer to chimps. But it also does do what you were saying, I think, which is to give one chills a little bit, because it really emphasizes that some of the things that we would most like to see abolished in humans, namely the tremendous tendencies for taking advantage of power to abuse other people, those tendencies are pretty deep in us. That is chilling. There's no question about it.
Speaking of those dark tendencies, one of the darker among them, and you were an editor of a book called Sexual Coercion in Primates and Humans. What's the evolutionary explanation for things like rape?
By the way, you said that chimps are very nasty and include rape. They very rarely rape themselves deliberately. They very rarely rape. And the reason that chimps very rarely do it is because obviously it's a male behavior, and the females are interested in having being mated by almost every male on almost every occasion. Oh, wow. And there's a logic to that. And the logic is that any female who has a baby and meets a male who could not possibly have fathered that baby has to fear that male, because he might kill the baby. And the reason he would want to kill the baby is because if it's not his, definitely not his, then the sooner she is without a baby, then the sooner she will come into heat again, into estrus, and will be available for a male like him to have a chance at mating her and conceiving with her. That means that it pays a female to mate all the males in her community sufficiently often, one can imagine, that all the males can remember having mated her.
Oh my God.
And think that she is a possible mother of his child.
Wow.
So that's the logic. And that means that if a male wants to mate a female, it's not very often that she is going to resist. She might have some special reasons for it in terms of the contemporary social dynamics. For instance, she might see a more dominant male out of the corner of her eye and doesn't want to get into a fight when he tries to stop the male who's courting her. But in general, she's willing to mate any male. And in fact, she's very sexually active and does a lot of invitation to males to mate. The one circumstance in which a female is most likely to get raped is when she is being courted by her brother.
Mm.
Because she seems to be more sensitive to the dangers of an inbred mating than he is. And so the few cases of real rape where a male tries to get a female to mate, she screams and tries to avoid him, and he just comes charging after her and grabs her and throws her around and beats her up and stomps on her until she agrees to do what he wants to do. That is mostly brothers attacking sisters.
Wow.
Well, that's a discourse on rape in chimpanzees.
Yeah.
Probably more than you wanted to hear, but
not at all.
was about sexual coercion in general.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's interesting with chimpanzees because on the one hand, I've just been describing how it's in the female's interest to mate with males a lot. And, you know, maybe on an average baby, the female has mated several hundred times and distributed those matings pretty evenly across all of the males in the group. So maybe she's mated 500 times, maybe 1,000 times, and each male will have had some tens of copulations, that sort of thing. Well, that's the female's point of view. From the male's point of view, of course, what he wants is to have as many of those matings as possible for himself, as opposed to sharing them with all these other lousy males. The way evolution works is that favors behavior that leads to his genes being passed on to the next generation. So it's in the male's interest to stop other males from mating, and therefore for the female to respond most quickly, most effectively, most willingly to him. And that's relevant particularly when the female is most sexually attractive, which is in the 2 or 3 days closest to when she ovulates, produces the egg. And during that time, all the males are around her like a honeypot. They just all want a piece of her. So she might have 50 copulations in a day. And during that time, some males will get more copulations than expected by chance. Well, the males who do best in relationship to their own ability to fight other males are the ones who have been most coercive to that female in previous days, weeks, or even months. And that means, when we say he's been most coercive to her, that he has been physically aggressive to her, beating her up. So you see this very odd behavior where a female who is not in oestrus, a female who may be weeks or months away from being in oestrus, is all of a sudden, out of nowhere, attacked by some male. And this feels puzzling. And then what you see over time is that she will be particularly heavily attacked and frequently attacked by a particular male. So that male is her principal aggressor. Well, it turns out that her principal aggressor subsequently is the one who is going to mate her more often than any other male does, and is the one who is most likely to be the father of her baby. So that's how effective he is in coercing her into mating with him more often than she does with other males. And how exactly that happens, we haven't really parsed out. Is it because she mates the other males less, or is it because she mates him more quickly and more readily when he is the one doing the soliciting? It's probably both of those things.
Do you think that's at all related to the phenomenon where women who are domestically abused stay with their partners? And I know women who have been abused by their boyfriends and come up with all kinds of rationalizations for why to stay, and it's horrible. But do you think that's at all connected, or is that a separate thing?
I don't know. Obviously, one of the reasons that women don't leave the abusive men is because they're fearful.
Yes.
And they've got reason to be fearful, particularly in the cases where the men are proactively aggressive. People who've studied sexual violence distinguish between men who are reactively aggressive and men who are proactively aggressive. And it's the proactively aggressive ones that turn into the stalkers who will hunt down a woman who has left them and kill her. I mean, we know that they get these horrendous stories all too often. I can well see that part of the reason that she stays is for fear of what happens if she leaves. But yes, it's intriguing and sort of, you know, rather daunting to think about the possibility that there is some kind of evolutionarily selected dynamic by which women actually come to prefer their abusers at some dark, deep level. And the basis of that would presumably be something like that even if he is abusive to her, there is the benefit that he is protecting her from other men. And so she gets some sort of, you know, minor benefit in that way. I am not saying that I think that that's definitely an answer, but I can see that, you know, it's a conceivable dynamic to be thought about in humans.
Another thing I wanted to ask you on that subject is I'm friends with a bunch of hippy dippy people, and they seem to believe that primates, or not so much primates, but humans in the far past, like hundreds of thousands of years ago, were almost entirely polyamorous. That monogamy was, you know, not was no more of a thing than being a vegetarian was. Is that accurate in your estimate?
I don't think it's something that you can strongly challenge either way. You can't say strongly that it definitely happened and or the strongly that it didn't happen. The time when I think we'd be talking about this would be, I don't even know. But if you read the data as I do to say that prior to 300,000 years ago, we had a primate-like system in which there was an alpha male who bullied his way to the top and then took advantage of being at the top by mating with as many females as possible. It is still possible that there were a few other males in the group, that it was vital for the females to be able to mate so that they would not be aggressive to her babies, infanticidal to her babies. You know, you could argue that. So it's conceivable that 300,000 years ago and more, there was polyamory of the type that you would characterize in chimpanzees. You know, the word polyamory refers to poly, many, and amor, love, right? And it occurs to me that even though polyamory is a way that you could describe the chimpanzee system, you wouldn't want to if you wanted to focus on the love aspect. Because, you know, this is sex at its rawest with absolutely no hint of long-term affection. So, you know, whether or not there was polyamory in the sense that your friends would like it to be, in which it was, you know, much more than just raw sex, which involved fairly brief copulations, averaging in chimpanzees something like 8 seconds. That seems to me a harder ask.
I see. Was there a specific time that we can trace back in human history to when monogamy became more of a standard?
No. It's very much a guess, I would say, at the moment.
Okay.
In my book, I speak about the importance of language becoming so sophisticated by 300,000 years ago that people could form rather sophisticated conspiracies based on talking to each other, sharing ideas. And prior to that, language would have existed in some form, but it would have been just a bit less delicate. The reason I mention language is because I find it quite hard to imagine how you would get a human style of monogamy prior to the evolution of language. And the reason is that in the way that hunters and gatherers get their food, men and women are separate during the day. and most readers of the fossil and archaeological record agree that the pattern of male foraging being more focused on hunting large animals, and the female strategy of being more focused on finding relatively predictable foods like roots and mollusks and that sort of thing, that this seems likely to have been a very deep distinction that went back perhaps the whole last 2 million years. That means that men and women were separate during the day, and therefore it means that there were lots of opportunities for cuckoldry, just as there are in our contemporary society today. And of course, that leads to a lot of problems. You know, men and women come back and meet each other in the evening over the evening meal or whatever it is. And if a man is suspicious of his wife, or if a woman is suspicious of her husband, then there's a row. And that makes every sense in terms of evolutionary biology. But it's difficult to understand how you could have had a system like this where each individual, male or female, would be interested in mate guarding, would be interested in making sure their spouse doesn't run off with somebody else, if you don't have language. Because you need language to be able to quiz your partner as to what happened and why. Without that, if the men go one way and the women go another, but not all in the same group, that is to say, not all the men in one single group and not all the women in their own group, then there's lots of opportunity during the day for people to meet up behind the bush. And so that's why I think that monogamy is difficult to imagine until you have a system of absentee mate guarding even in the absence of your own physical presence, which is achieved by quizzing witnesses, quizzing your partner, and so on.
Wow.
So for me, you know, I don't think that monogamy would really have been possible until the evolution of language, unless you have a totally different foraging system. And the primates, you know, bear this out. So all the primates that are monogamous, the monkeys and apes that are monogamous are with each other all day.
That makes sense. That's going to put a pin in a lot of people's bubbles, but I think that's a reasonable explanation. The last question I wanted to ask you before I let you go, you had also written a book called Catching Fire about how cooking food played a major role in the evolution of our brains. And I was curious, have you heard at all about the theory that humans, or that early hominids ate like psychedelic mushrooms and things like that? It's referred to as the stoned ape theory. I was curious if this is taken seriously at all by reputable scientists.
I have heard of it. I read about it in Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. And I followed it up enough to realize that nobody takes it seriously, is the short answer. It's an odd theory, and I can't even remember exactly how the theory works as to why supposedly taking psychedelic mushrooms would foster a more development of a human brain or human ideas or what. The great difficulty, of course, from thinking about this from an evolutionary perspective is that, in general, individuals who take psychoactive compounds that are psychedelic are putting themselves in a more vulnerable position. And they're going to be vulnerable to predators, they're going to be vulnerable to, I don't know, rainstorms, they're going to be vulnerable to the rival who is wanting to take advantage of you.
Yeah.
So if you're living in the relatively tough natural world, to make yourself relatively immobile and or so fascinated by the colors on the back of an insect that you don't notice the approaching lion, or, you know, other ways in which your mind is not well attuned to your environment, is obviously maladaptive. And I mention this partly because in Michael Pollan's book, he says that, he cites somebody who says that a number of species of primates have been suggested to take psychedelic compounds from natural plants. And I wrote to him about that and said, do you have any follow-up citations for this? And it turns out that they basically do not appear to exist. It just seems that there's no evidence at all that any primates do this. So the stoned ape theory would have to be the stoned human theory, and I still don't buy it.
So when you sent him that email, did he just say, I'll get back to you? Or was he not able to produce any citations or any evidence supporting that claim?
Well, I don't mean to dump on him because
I'm
a huge admirer of him and so on, but it so happened that this particular claim of a number of primates, 21 or 22 primate species of primates known to eat psychedelic mushrooms, did not have a citation, which, you know, the great majority of the claims in his book did. So that's why I wrote to him to ask, and he said he couldn't remember, he'd get back to me, and then he consulted with his fact checker, and the fact checker said she thought it was in such and such a book, I read one of the books, which is called Intoxication by Ronald Siegel, and that doesn't have any solid facts at all. It just has some very loose anecdotes that, you know, are totally unconvincing. So that seems to be where that particular, let's call it rumor, stands.
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of publishing houses have sort of cut their budgets for things like fact checking and editors, and that's really harmed a lot of books. I mean, I love the How to Change Your Mind. I think it's a great book, but interesting to note. You know, it seems like there's always, even in the best books, like some error somewhere. Well, anyway, on that note, Richard, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed this chat. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you to Richard Wrangham, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.